It's not a matter of getting rid of these parts or these aspects of ourselves. It's a question of actually getting to know them. And they all began as coping mechanisms. Really, it's when the past starts to loosen its hold over your present. If trauma is the loss of connection to self, then healing is the reconnection.
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
In this episode, we discuss topics that include sexual abuse and trauma that might be triggering to some audiences. Please be advised.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card, you call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone if you only had a Discover card. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
What I read about your stuff, what I see about your content, is a lot of people are lost based on trauma. And past traumas cause certain addictions or certain behaviors and routines that maybe are some healthy addictions or unhealthy addictions, but it seems to be like a lot of unhealthy addictions.
Well, can I interrupt right
there? Yes, please.
No such thing as a healthy addiction.
No such thing.
If it's healthy, it's not an addiction. If it's an addiction, it's not healthy. There are passions. Uh-huh. There are habits that are healthy. But they're not addictions.
I define, like working out. Like
Well, that can be an addiction or it can be healthy. Right. Like eating can be healthy, but it could be an addiction. Mm-hmm. I define addiction as any behavior in which a person finds temporary pleasure or relief and therefore craves, but then suffers negative consequences and cannot give it up. So if you're suffering negative consequences, so it's craving, relief, pleasure in the short term, harm in the long term, inability to give it up. That's what an addiction is. Now, if you have a behavior that's ongoing, but it has no negative consequences, it's not an addiction. It's a passion, it's a pleasure, it's a habit. It's a healthy habit, yeah. So for me, it's not an addiction. And also, a healthy habit, a person, if it no longer works for them, they can give it up. Mm-hmm. So for me, there's no healthy addiction.
There's no healthy addiction.
Yeah. In fact, the word addiction comes from a word for slavery. So there's no healthy slavery.
Interesting. So addiction, what is the root of addiction? The
word?
Yeah.
So in Roman times, an addictus was somebody who was assigned to another person to serve them because they owed them money and they couldn't pay it back.
An addictus.
Yeah, addictus was like a indentured slave who had to work off the debt. So that's where the word actually comes from, is slavery, is a form of slavery.
So if you're addicted to something, you are a slave to that craving.
Absolutely. You have no choice. A slave has no choice.
Wow. And they have no free will, essentially.
Yeah. And I've had my own addictive behaviors and nothing like the patients that I worked with, but insofar as I had them, literally, even though I was a well-paid, middle-class, successful doctor, I was not exercising any free choice.
Really?
Over my behaviors, no.
When did you, what was the main addiction that you were, tied to? And when did you learn
how
to break free of that?
Well, so in my life, the main addictions have been to work.
To work.
Yeah.
Work hard, succeed. Achieve
more and more patience, more and more success, more and more. More and more is the essence of addiction. It's always more and more. And there's a reason why I developed that addiction. And that was the hardest, that's the hardest one to give up. Then I was addicted for a long time to shopping for classical compact discs. And when I say addicted, I mean I would spend thousands of dollars a day.
On CDs?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, really. And I would lie to my wife about it, and I would neglect my patients. And as soon as I left the store, thinking now I'm complete, my collection is full. Half an hour later, I had to run back. And as I describe in my book, An Addiction in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, I once left a woman in labor in a hospital to go get a symphony. So that's an addiction.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like that. Now, the interesting thing about addiction is that I wasn't using substances.
You weren't smoking or drinking drugs.
No, but I was looking for a chemical hit.
Dopamine,
yeah. So I was on a dopamine fiend, you might say. And I get it through those particular behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so that's what my addiction was. How did I give it up? Well, it took a long time.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of struggle, and finally I just realized that the cost was greater than the... In fact, if I started listening now to all the CDs that I have at home and did nothing but listen for the rest of my life...
You wouldn't finish.
I probably wouldn't finish.
Wow. So how long would you say... When did you realize, okay, this is an addiction? This is an unhealthy...
I realized it long before I gave it up.
Like years, 10 years, decades?
Years.
Years.
Yeah, years.
How long does it normally take for someone when they realize this is unhealthy, this thing I'm doing, this addiction is not good for me, until they actually give it up? Is there any data on that?
I couldn't answer that one. Yeah. I think it's a highly variable and individual issue. It has to do with what resources they have to heal. It has to do with what support they have. It has to do with what cost this habit is exacting on their lives. It has to do also with some belief that there's a part of us that's actually healthy and we can get in touch with it. You know, there has to be a cool combination of factors. And it's very, very individual. It also depends, of course, the degree of trauma a person suffered. And addictions are always about, like, you've heard my definition of addiction, and I'm sure if I asked you, if I'm talking to 1,000 people, put your hands up if, according to my definition, you've got an addiction. Virtually everybody in the room will put their hands up. Maybe there'll be two liars who... But 998 people. And then I asked them, not what was wrong with the addiction, but what was right about it? What did you get from it? So if I asked you that, so you've had your addictive behaviors. If I asked you, I don't care what it was to, but if I asked you, what did you get from it? What would
you get? Some type of relief. You get some type of pleasure. You get some type of...
Specifically.
What do you get from it?
What do you get from it? What did it give you temporarily? Whatever it was, I don't even care what it was.
It's you get an escape.
Okay, escape, right.
Yeah, you're not thinking about the pain or the shame or the insecurity.
No. So who needs to escape?
Me.
No, but I mean, what kind of person needs to escape?
Oh, a scared person.
Scared person is somebody who's imprisoned, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Somebody who's not free.
It's trapped.
Yeah, somebody's trapped, exactly. And I know in your book on toxic masculinity, you talk about being trapped in it. Mm-hmm. Trapped is the very word you use.
Yes.
And
I felt trapped most of my childhood.
That's the whole point. So what I'm saying is that addiction is never a choice, and it's not some kind of genetic disease, which that is total nonsense. What it actually is an attempt to solve a problem in your life. Mm. In your case, you were trying to solve the problem of being trapped, which is based on your childhood trauma, which you very publicly talk about. In my case, the workaholism was about trying to prove to myself that I had the right to exist, that it was important.
That you're worthy of love.
That I was worthy of love, exactly, acceptance and all that. Now, that also came from my childhood experience. So addiction is never like either a disease as such. It can behave like a disease, but it isn't a disease as such. It's also not a choice anybody makes. It's actually an attempt to solve a deep life problem that was imposed on a person by trauma in every case.
Wow. Yeah. Is it possible for someone to heal a deep wound on their own, a trauma from decades past that they've had an addiction to trying to escape from? Is it possible to do it on your own? Or is it really take support? Someone's, a team? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think very rarely it is possible for an individual. Maybe they have some deep spiritual experience. Maybe they're out there in nature and all of a sudden they're at one with the universe.
They feel a presence. They feel the connected. Presence. Yeah.
Exactly. So that can happen. It does happen to some people.
But and they just to choose, I'm going to decide not to do this anymore.
Well, they realize they don't need to because they're free.
They feel free. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Very rare. For most of us people, beings that walk this earth, it takes a lot of self-awareness, it takes a lot of support, connection, guidance. So I'd say, if you're listening and you've got one of these issues where you're addicted to something in the way that Lewis and I are just talking about, don't wait for that miraculous moment. Get the help, because you have a much better chance that way.
Yeah. So what would you say is the root cause of all addiction then? Is it feeling a wound? Is it feeling trapped by something that's happened in the past?
The being trapped itself is a sign of a wound. So in fact, the word trauma means wound. Mm. The Greek origin of the word trauma is a wound. So children who are hurt, but they're not supported, seen, accepted, and helped, they get trapped in a wound. Mm. And being trapped in a wound and being trapped in the behaviors to escape from the wound, that's how the trauma shows up in our lives.
Interesting. And in our culture and our society. You know, I talk about this in my book as well, about how as a young boy growing up in the Midwest, in Ohio, I didn't see examples of older men or athletes that I aspired to be like talking about their emotions or talking about healing or talking about, you know, I had a trauma, talking about how to, you know, navigate the full range of emotions. It was more, you just get made fun of if you cried.
Yeah.
You get picked on and called, you know, things you don't want to be called. You're kicked out of the tribe. You're not accepted in the tribe in your, you know, boys group growing up.
Yeah.
And so I feel like culturally there's a lot of pain with men and women, obviously, but that it seems to be is causing a lot of the stress in the world right now. It's just this cultural pain.
Well, if I may be self-serving, my new book is called The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. So just as you say, the trauma that people are experiencing massively isn't just personal to them. It's also a sign of a culture that's completely out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say out of whack, the things we consider, the reason I call the book The Myth of Normal is what I'm saying is that the things that are considered normal in society are not at all normal from the point of view of human life and human needs.
It's not healthy.
It's totally unhealthy, so that the addictions and the diseases and the mental illnesses that people develop are actually normal responses to an abnormal situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that whatever addiction you had, or even this mask of rigid masculinity that you tried to adopt for a while until it cracked for you.
Right, needing to win, needing to be the best, needing to.
But that was a normal response.
To survive.
To survive, exactly. So that the abnormality wasn't in you, it was in the situation that you're in. That's what I mean by a toxic culture.
Yeah.
And I know, again, in your book, you talk about these public figures that all of a sudden you realize we're talking about their emotions.
Yeah.
But that's fairly new.
Very in the last like 5-10 years.
Yeah, so these days athletes will talk about their sexual abuse.
This didn't happen until 10 years ago. Yeah. Really? And really more 3 to 5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And so now there's why do you feel like people are now starting to open up who are more public figures? Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I think what's happened that the toxicity of the culture, one of my subtitles is toxic culture, and it's got so bad. There's a Greek playwright that I quote in my book. He's Aeschylus, and one of his plays, he said that the way the gods created us, human beings, that we have to suffer into truth. And I think that the degree of suffering, now most people I know who engage in a path of self-exploration and truth, they didn't do it because all of a sudden they just made a decision. They just suffered so much. So the suffering can actually wake you up. And I think to answer your question, this society has got to the point where the suffering is so intense and so widespread that something had to crack open.
Right.
So I think that's why, you know, so it's got so bad that it couldn't be hidden anymore.
Why do you think in our modern society with all the medical and scientific advances and all the knowledge out there that there's so much chronic pain, though, so much suffering, when we have more information and knowledge and tools than ever before?
Actually, we don't. We have less.
Mm.
What we have is a lot more physiological, physical science, which is great. You know, I mean, if I needed a heart transplant, I'd be very grateful for modern medicine or if a broken bone or anything. Mm-hmm. But we've forgotten something that human beings have always known. And for example, I write about this friend of mine. His name is Louis Mel Madrona, and he's an American physician. He's Lakota background.
Okay.
And he told me that he's just like me. He's full of respect for Western medicine. I was trained in it. He was trained in it. We also see what's missing. And he said that in his tradition, when somebody gets sick, the whole community gathers and thanks the person and says, you're carrying some dysfunction in our whole culture. So your healing is our healing.
Wow.
So they get that the individual represents the culture and the environment and the family and the community. Now, Western medicine totally forgets that. We separate the mind from the body. So we often, when I speak to groups, I ask people if in the last 5 years you've been to a neurologist or an oncologist or a cardiologist or gastroenterologist or a rheumatologist, any kind of an ologist, put your hand up. So people put their hands up. I said, keep your hands up if they ask you about stress in your life, trauma in your childhood.
Relationships,
exactly. How you feel about your work, how you feel about yourself as a human being. Very few hands stay up. And those questions, which have to do with, number one, the unity of mind and body, which is only scientific fact, and the inseparableness of one human being from another, Western medicine completely ignores, which is contrary to science.
Mm.
It's not only contrary to ancient wisdom, it's also contrary to modern science, because we have tens of thousands of studies to show that you can't separate the mind from the body. Tens of thousands of studies showing how emotions significantly influence the onset of illness, how relationships do, you know. There's a wonderful psychiatrist here in LA, you may know of him or him, Daniel Siegel. And Dan Siegel talks about what he calls interpersonal neurobiology, which means that our brains are not separate. Something in you will sense the tension in me and will pick up on that. And that'll
the intuition,
you.
And
that'll change your brain. And I take it a step further. I talk about interpersonal biology, so that what happens to people physiologically is very affected. And I'll give you two examples.
Yes.
But affected by their culture and their family. So we've known for decades that children whose parents are stressed are much more likely to have asthma.
Mm.
The parents' stresses affect the physiology of the child's
breathing.
Lungs. The breathing, that they narrow the air tubes, they cause inflammation. By the way, how do we treat asthma with stress hormones? Adrenaline and cortisol. You know, we know American black women, the more experiences of racism that you have to endure, the greater the risk for asthma.
Really?
We know that men who were sexually abused in childhood, the risk of heart disease triples. I could go on. Women who suffer symptoms of PTSD severely, their risk of ovarian cancer doubles. Why? Because you can't separate the emotions from the body. It's one unit, scientifically speaking, not just from the point of view of indigenous wisdom, but on modern science. So when you say, despite all this knowledge, I'm saying what's missing from the knowledge
is wisdom.
Is the wisdom. Mm. And not just the wisdom. Even the science.
Right.
That's what's so ironic. So I'm a physician, and as doctors, we always talk about evidence-based practice. And I say, my God, I only wish we had evidence-based practice. Let's look at the evidence.
Right.
You know, what's the evidence for separating the mind from the body? But multiple sclerosis, this mysterious illness. The guy who first described multiple sclerosis was a French neurologist called Jean-Martin Charcot in the 19th century. He said that it was a disease caused by grief and long-term worry. Since then, there's been multiple studies showing the relationship of stress, trauma, and multiple sclerosis. You go to the average neurologist with symptoms of MS, nobody's going to ask you about your trauma. Nobody's going to ask you about your stress. And why is that significant? Because if you deal with the trauma and the stress, your multiple sclerosis can actually improve significantly.
Wow.
So there's a huge gap between the scientific evidence and how we practice medicine. And what we call scientific evidence-based practice is miraculous. It's amazing, but it's way too narrow.
Mm-hmm. What about something like arthritis? What is that? Would you say that's connected to?
Okay, that's been studied as well. So there was a great Canadian physician who actually was one of the founding physicians at Johns Hopkins Medical School. His name is William Osler. He said in 1880 that rheumatoid arthritis is caused by long-term worry and stress.
Long-term worry and stress.
Yeah. Now, since then.
In 1890?
1880 or 90.
Wow.
Yeah. He said this then. Since then, multiple dozens of studies showing a relationship between trauma, stress, and rheumatoid arthritis. Do you think the average rheumatologist knows anything about that?
No.
So that people go to, I know people in my book, The Myth of Normal, I talk about people with MS or arthritis who once they start recognizing that the flare-ups of the disease actually manifest stresses in their lives, if they learn how to deal with those stresses. One woman told me that I have beautiful conversations with my rheumatoid arthritis. She says it was my best teacher. Because when every time it shows up, I know that I'm out of alignment with myself.
Yeah.
My career not only requires me to travel, but also gives me the freedom to. Traveling has brought me so many positive experiences and memories. Like that time I spent the holidays at an Airbnb in Big Bear with some of my extended family, and it was the perfect way to come together and connect with my family that I don't see that often. If you have a similar setup that allows you to travel often, have you ever thought about your empty home while you're gone? More specifically, how you can make some extra money by keeping your home occupied while you're out of town. I'm a big advocate for setting up a side hustle to give you an extra stream of income, and Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start. Many people host on Airbnb, including some friends of mine, but there are some people out there who've never even realized their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you've got yourself an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. So listen, we all know life is full of yada yada, like those quote unquote free trials that somehow still charge your card for something, or when companies have those sneaky gotchas hiding deep in the fine print. And I know you've dealt with yada yada before, like those bills that keep going up and up for no reason at all. Or when budget airlines promise a cheap fare, but then charge you for every little thing until you realize you're paying more than you would have somewhere else. And yes, it is possible to outsmart yada yada, like triple checking airline deals to make sure all you need is already included, but you don't take yada yada in life, so don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Metro by T-Mobile has no contracts, no credit checks, no surprises, and nada yada yada. Stop by one of over 6,000 Metro stores nationwide.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
You're out of somewhere, you need to have a conversation with yourself or get back in alignment. It's interesting. I was telling you this before off camera that in a previous relationship that I was in, I was feeling a lot of chest pain and kind of tightness in my throat.
Yeah.
And at one point, like I was starting to get like this, I don't know if it was a rash or some type of flare up, like below my belly button.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? Like, I've never had some type of like eczema or skin condition or something. Mm-hmm. It was like this kind of bright red flare up. And I was like, do I have a disease? Like, what is this? You know? And it's fascinating because I was telling you, like, the moment after many, many months of therapy and starting to integrate the lessons of healing and really feel it internally, I started to feel this sense of peace inside of me for the first time. I didn't feel trapped for the first time in myself, in my heart and in my body. And almost overnight, like, this flare-up was there for months. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm having, I had like allergy tests and I was like, maybe it's peanuts, I don't know. All these different like foods that I'm eating. And I was like eliminating the foods and it was still there. It was almost overnight when I felt the peace inside of me, the flare-ups went away and they haven't come back. And I was like,
so if you had come to me with that rash, I would have asked you.
Not what are you eating?
No, I wouldn't. Well, I might have. I mean, those are good questions. But I also would have asked you, what is your body saying no to?
It's rejecting.
That you're not saying no to.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, now, a flare-up, if you take that word flare-up, which is what you used.
It's inflammation, right? Something's inflamed.
Okay, right. But where else do you use, what else flares up? You know what flares up? Is rage, anger. But you had anger that you weren't expressing.
Right.
That, hence, your body flares up.
Yes.
We know that suppressed emotions cause inflammation. So had you come to me, not had you come to me when I was out of medical school, because I wouldn't know anything about this. Nobody teaches you this stuff. But if you had come to me more recently, I would have asked you, well, Louis, what is your body saying no to that you're not saying no to? And that happens in two major areas. Relationships and work, you know.
Interesting.
And so the body sends us signals. We can learn from it. And now the problem is that you go to the average physician.
They're not going to ask those things.
They're just going to try and collude with you to try and get rid of the symptom.
Find the root. No.
Which is, that's okay. I mean, you don't want to sit there with a rash. It's fine. But also, let's look at the source of it.
Yes.
And the source is always assumed to be something physical. Maybe they'll think of food. Maybe they'll think of some toxin. They will not think of your emotions, even though the mind and the body are inseparable.
How much stronger do you think the emotional weight or trauma is than physical toxins, you know, in terms of affecting the body?
I can't make that assessment because I don't know what study would even compare the two.
Sure.
So I don't want to speak off the cuff. But what I can tell you is that though emotions are really primary in most chronic conditions, and if you deal with them, now in this society where there's all these toxins in the environment and junk in the food and all this, who knows?
Everything.
What I know is that the emotions play a huge role and that can have an impact on their illness. And the other thing I don't know about you when you write books, but I write books as much for myself as for anybody else.
100%.
Yeah.
So, the show is for me.
Yeah, exactly. So I get to learn a lot when I'm writing. So one of the things I learned when I was writing The Myth of Normal was even how we think about disease. Like, people say, I have eczema, or I have depression, or I have rheumatoid arthritis, or I have ADD. Now, there's an assumption there, isn't there? The assumption is, first of all, is that there's this thing called ADD, there's this thing called eczema, there's this thing called rheumatoid arthritis, or there's this thing called depression, then there's an I, and the I has that thing. But that thing has got its own separate, independent nature. But to say that I have this disease makes the assumption that this disease got a separate life and nature of its own. It doesn't. What if we saw disease of all kinds, mental or physical or addiction, not as the things in themselves that have their own nature, but as processes that manifest our lives? And if I live my life differently, then I can have an impact on that process, so that process will change.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly actually how it is. So for shorthand language, I understand it's helpful to say I have depression.
Right.
But
how important is the words we choose?
But if we buy into that language, we're actually missing the point because you don't have it. There's no it that's separate from you. And that means that if you change yourself, in fact, there's a friend of mine now, a recent friend, Dr. Jeff Rediger, who's a psychiatrist at Harvard. And last year he wrote a book called Cured, The Science of Spontaneous Healing. So that was the subtitle. Now, he studied people who were terminally ill, documentedly so. They had no prognosis whatsoever, and then they get better.
So they were terminally ill. They were not supposed to survive.
They're not supposed to survive.
Supposed to die in a few years or something.
Or months or weeks. I've talked to such people myself.
And they've cured their disease.
There's a woman called a psychologist called Kelly Turner who studied the same thing. She wrote a book called Radical Remission. So all three of us have looked at these people. They did it in a research kind of way. Mm-hmm. I just did it impressionistically, you know. But I do check out the histories with people's doctors. We all know people who are supposed to have 2 months to live or 6 months to live. Either medical treatment has failed or they refuse medical treatment. Then all of a sudden the disease goes away. Mm. I think all three of us have found that what makes the biggest difference is that the person changes their relationship to themselves.
Wow.
And there's always trauma in the background. Now, Jeff and Kelly have documented people. They go on diets, they take supplements, they start meditating.
They go into nature.
They go into nature, the whole thing.
All those things are great.
Yeah. And I think but I think Jeff and I agree, and I think Kelly would probably agree as well, that the biggest shift is in one's relationship with oneself. Gosh. In other words, the life changes, the process changes. Now, I'm not promising everybody who's listening you can cure yourself. I mean, you know, this is not snake oil. I'm just talking about the importance of recognizing the impact of emotions and one's relationship to oneself on one's physiology.
Yes.
That's all I'm talking about.
There's an external environment, and then there's an internal environment,
yeah.
You know, our emotional environment that is connected to our nervous system, our heart, our brain, the whole body and everything. And if our emotional environment is sick, then we're probably going to be physically sick as well.
Well that's what your story actually illustrates, isn't it? Mm-hmm. As soon as you create an internal environment, your physical issues abate.
Mm-hmm.
You know. By the way, speaking of, I just noticed I'm getting too excited here. This is my passion. I mean, I just could go on about this forever, but I'm also noticing probably I'm getting a bit too heated here.
You're getting warm.
I don't physically so much. I just noticed I need to calm down a bit. I don't want to talk too fast.
No, I like it.
Okay.
this is exciting for me.
Yeah.
Well, I just feel like this is the, what you were just saying, emotional repression is a major cause of physical illness. It may not be the only cause, there's other factors, but what we suppress usually comes to the surface in some way. Is
that's
that correct?
That's the whole point.
And most of us, I'll speak for myself, I wasn't taught, and I think most of us are not taught on how to express the emotional traumas, the emotional pains, fears, insecurities, shames, guilt. We're not taught the skills. It's one of the reasons why I started the School of Greatness, because I was like, I wish I would have learned these skills in school.
Yeah.
You know, most people's parents are messed up in some way or have some issues and they aren't taught this. And so I grew up in a household that was very stressful and chaotic, and there wasn't stability.
So did my kids, by the way.
Right. And you're like the guy, right?
But I wasn't the guy then.
You weren't the guy then.
Yeah.
So your kids had some traumas that they had to face because of you and their parents.
It's not even a matter of skills learning. It's deeper than that. Because you don't have to teach any one-day-old baby how to express their emotions, do you?
No.
If they're sad, lonely, do you hear about it? If they're hungry or uncomfortable, do you hear about it?
Uh-huh.
Of course you do. There's nothing to teach. You have to allow it. And you have to give space for it. And you have to hear it and respond to it. The problem with most parents is not that they don't teach their kids these skills. Is that how they really live their lives because of their own traumas and because of the stresses in the society. They actually discourage kids.
Stop crying.
From what's natural.
Suck it up.
Well, look.
Don't do this. Don't do that, right?
Well, there's a very famous Canadian psychologist. I don't know if he's been on your program, but he he says that an angry child should be made to sit by themselves until they come back to normal.
Interesting.
In other words, anger in a two-year-old is not normal. Mm. And we have to socialize it out of them. Now,
Interesting.
There's nothing more natural than an angry two-year-old.
There's nothing more natural than an angry two-year-old.
Yeah. They get frustrated, you know. Right. They want a cookie. They get a cookie before
they don't get what they want.
Yeah, they want a cookie. You know, they want a cookie before dinner. And if you're a good parent, you're not going to give them a cookie before dinner.
Right.
So
when does you teach, or when does someone learn how to not express anger every 10 minutes, though?
Well, here's the point: if that two-year-old then starts screaming or throwing a tantrum, or getting angry, if you say time out and you're not going to be with them. Now you're presenting the child with a tragic dilemma. I can have my authentic emotion, or I can have my relationship with my parent on whom my life depends. So I can be authentic, or I can be attached in a relationship, but I can't have both.
Interesting.
Now, children,
because if I'm not authentic, or if I'm authentic, then I'm going to be alone.
Exactly.
I'm going to be on timeout or whatever,
And to the child, the timeout is life-threatening.
Because you might be alone forever, right? It's
like the child doesn't know that, you see.
Yeah.
So basically, you're threatening the child with depriving them of their greatest need, which is the connection with you.
Yeah, love.
Yeah, the love, yeah. Now,
but isn't there a point, though, if you're a 21-year-old man now and you're, you know, screaming every 10 minutes because you don't get the cookie?
But that's not the answer.
Right.
The answer is when they're screaming, to pick them up. You're angry at daddy, aren't you? You really wish you had that cookie.
Yeah.
Oh, I get it. You know, and then the child relaxes and the anger moves through them. And you know what they learn? That anger is just something that moves through you. You can let go of it. If you don't see the child, don't accept the child's emotion, they're going to have to repress it.
They have to stuff it.
What's another word for stuffing? It's pushing down.
Trap it, yeah.
Well, pushing down.
Uh-huh.
What's another word for pushing down? Depressing. Mm. Where does depression come from? It's not this disease. Depression comes from having had to push down your emotions.
Wow.
Literally, you had to push down your emotions. In other words, why did you have to push down your emotions? To stay connected to your parents. In other words, it was a coping mechanism. And what I'm saying is that a lot of illness, whether of the mind or the body or both, comes from coping mechanisms. There are normal coping mechanisms in response to an abnormal situation. It's not normal for a child to be banished from the presence of the parent. In fact, if you look at indigenous people, they carry their kids everywhere. The kids are always with the parents. And the pilgrims, when they arrived in North America, they're very upset with how the natives reared their children. You know why? Because the indigenous people did not hit their kids.
They didn't hit their kids.
They didn't hit their kids. And the Christians couldn't understand this.
Why they didn't, create obedience with them, right?
Yeah.
And so what do they do?
They nourish them. And when you nourish a child, see, nature has got a natural agenda, is that you should grow up to be a self-regulated adult in connection with yourself and with other people. That's nature's agenda. It's like nature has an agenda for an acorn to become an oak tree. But an acorn doesn't spontaneously become an oak tree. It has to have the right conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a question of teaching the oak tree, the acorn to be an oak tree. Just give it the nourishment and the sunlight and the earth and the irrigation that it needs. Its nature is to become an oak tree.
Right.
The nature of human beings is to become self-regulated, socially responsible creatures. That's how we evolved. Given the right conditions, that will happen. So it's not a question of teaching all these things. Yeah, there's some teaching involved. Mostly it's the question of meeting children's needs, giving them the right conditions, and then they will develop self-regulation.
Mm-hmm.
They learn it because you're self-regulated, so they're watching you.
You're not reactive and explosive and screaming.
You know, your eyes, oh, I'm angry. Okay, I'm angry. But you're not screaming at the kid. You know, so in the right environment, these traits spontaneously evolve or develop in a human being. So our society is always about how do we teach these skills and no skills? Well, teaching is important, but more important is the child's spontaneous growth,
mm-hmm.
given the right environment. And what I'm saying about this toxic culture, we don't give our kids the right environment.
Yeah, I mean, you hear the number, the statistic that 50% of marriages turn into divorce these days. And also, probably, I think when I had Esther Perel on, I was like, how many of the 50% that are married are actually happy? It's a very small percentage, too.
Well, and so, so I've had a marriage that we've had a lot of unhappiness. We've been married 53 years now.
53?
Yeah, we're very happy together.
You know, you are.
But it took us a lot of work, a lot of commitment. But here's what I want to say. There's two ways you can tell if a marriage is unhappy. One is you can ask the parents. The other is you can measure the cortisol level of the children.
Oh, wow.
Because the parents' stresses affect the physiology of the child.
Oh, man. My cortisol must have been off the charts when I was... It
probably would have been. And so in this society, and this is not the fault of individual parents, like... It begins in the uterus, actually. Already stresses on the pregnant woman will affect the physiology of the child.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. In this society, so many pregnant women are so stressed. In the States, particularly.
You're talking about more emotional stress because there's physical stress of, like, the body's expanding and growing and aches and pains, but the emotional stress.
Right? I mean the emotional stress of having to...
the nervous system
perform
stress.
...perform on the job or being in a difficult relationship. In one of the chapters in the book, I talk about, it begins with the diary of my wife, who was writing it when she was pregnant with one of our children, about how unhappy she was. And she's talking to the infant saying, please don't take this stress personally. Wow. And she wrote that, and I quoted it in The Myth of Normal. And she knew what I didn't know. And no, she was unhappy because of our relationship.
She was unhappy because of the relationship.
She was unhappy because of what was going on in her relationship with me. Being a workaholic doctor.
Not being there, not being available emotionally.
Exactly. And even blaming her, you know, for how I was feeling, you know.
Wow.
So she's talking to this infant inside her. And that's how I opened one of the chapters. So already in the uterus, these stresses start happening. A lot of evidence for that scientifically. Brain scans, blood work, all kinds of stuff. Then there's labor, which in our society is very often mechanical and emotionally very difficult. And in the United States, 25% of women have to go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. Now, that infant is meant to be with the mother for at least 9 months, I would say years, but at least 9 months. That infant is abandoned at 2 weeks. That's how they experience it.
Oh, man.
Even if they're looked after by someone else, but the infant needs the mother's body.
Yeah, my mom was working pretty fast after each one of us were born. You know, had to go back to work and.
And I'm not blaming the women.
Right.
They have no choice.
Yes.
I'm saying, but this society puts those stresses on women. It then doesn't support them through the pregnancy. Then it puts a lot, and not only that, we didn't grow up in individual isolated nuclear families, did we? We evolved in small band hunter-gatherer groups where people supported each other, where children were with adults all day, where adults collaborated. They had to, otherwise they wouldn't have survived.
Right.
So that's where our nature actually evolved. So when you get this society which tells you that people are by nature selfish and aggressive and competitive, which isolates mothers, in separate homes, where the community is more and more, you know, there's lots of work done by sociologists and others in the States about how communities are breaking down. There was that book, Bowling Alone, some years ago, 20 years ago now, about the breakdown of community, so that people are not getting support, and that means they're stressed.
And the mothers are doing it all on their own.
Exactly.
Right. And but they're also expecting the husband to, you know, work and also be at home, as opposed to reaching out to peers or family or friends.
Exactly. So it's a very unnatural culture. And no wonder so many kids are getting diagnosed. And with ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder or depression, you know, there's an article in the New Yorker a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, also in the New York Times, I think, about the rising rate of childhood and adolescent suicides in the U.S. It's mysterious. It's not mysterious. These kids are no longer having their developmental needs met. They feel alone and desperate and scared.
Mm-hmm. And then drug use is on the rise and addiction.
That's right.
Suicide.
There's nothing mysterious about it if you look at the cultural setting. it's only mysterious if we think we're dealing with isolated mental health issues or isolated physiological issues. But when you see the connections, nothing mysterious.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
So what are the main, I guess, mental health, are they diseases or are they not considered a disease? Like a depression, ADD, ADHD, what are the main mental health symptoms out in the world right now, would you say?
Yeah, so depression and anxiety are fast growing and they're major challenges. More and more kids are being diagnosed with ADHD. More and more kids are being diagnosed with something called oppositional defiant disorder, which...
What is that?
Oppositional... That's when a kid is defiant and oppositional and goes against adult values and adult expectations. But we think there's something wrong with the kid instead of looking at the context of what makes the kid...
The environment, you know,
No. Are these diseases? Well... You can talk about them as diseases to some degree, and certainly, you know, I've had depression and I've taken medication for it in my 40s, and it really made a difference for me. You might call it a disease, but actually, that's a shallow way of looking at it. Because actually, what does it go back to? It goes back to being a one-year-old infant or being a three-month-old infant. In the book, The Myth of Normal, the first chapter has a painting in it. The painting is by my wife, based on a photograph of me and my mother. This is Budapest, Hungary, 1944, and I'm 3 months of age. And my mother in the photograph is wearing the yellow star that Jews had to wear. My father was away in forced labor, and within 2 months, her parents would be killed in Auschwitz. Mm. That was my first year of life.
Oh my gosh.
And the look on my face is full of terror. I was absorbing my mother's fear and my mother's anxiety.
Because she had terror in her face and you're mimicking and
she had it in her body.
You're connected to her, I'm totally feeding 10 times a day.
Exactly.
And you're feeling the stress.
Exactly.
There's probably now no calm in her.
There's no calm there. But she's already so stressed and she's just trying to make sure that we survive. She's not there to really receive my feelings. And then when I'm a year old, or 11 months old, she hands me to a complete stranger in the street to save my life because she didn't think where we're staying I would survive for a day and probably I wouldn't have.
Wow.
So I didn't see her for five or six weeks.
Oh, man.
And
you're one?
I was one then, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And now, what could I do as a one-year-old? I could do two things. Or as an infant going through all that. First of all, how do I deal with all that stress? I tune out. I become absent-minded as an adaptive mechanism.
It's a coping mechanism.
Exactly. 55 years later, I'm diagnosed with ADHD, which is characterized by tuning out. Is it a disease? The heck, it's a disease. It started as a coping mechanism. I'm also diagnosed with depression. Why? Because in an environment, I had to push my feelings down in order to not to burden my mother, who was already burdened enough.
Create more peace and more,
So I took that on. So I pushed on my feelings. I depressed my feelings. Then I have this depression. So are they diseases? Well, you can talk about them that way, but I say they began as coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you another story. I'm 78 now, so 6-7 years ago. I'm in San Francisco. with a therapist, and I've taken mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
She works with mushrooms, and I've worked with psychedelics, and it's one of the things I write about. But this time I'm the patient, I'm the client. And I'm lying there on the mat under the influence of the psilocybin. And I know exactly who I am. I'm 71 years old. I'm a medical doctor. I'm a writer. I'm a speaker. I'm married to such as, you know, my wife, Ray. This is a therapist. So I'm not like hallucinating. I know exactly where I am. But at the same time, I'm experiencing myself as a one-year-old infant.
Oh, my goodness.
And this therapist is my mom. And I start crying and I say, I'm so sorry I've made your life so difficult.
Wow.
That's my one-year-old self. All of a sudden, under the influence, speaking up. I took it on that early that I'm responsible. Now, you talked about...
Oh, my gosh.
In our conversation before, you told me about how you were in this relationship and you couldn't leave it even long after you realized it wasn't right for you because you took on the responsibility of how the other person would feel
mm-hmm.
if you would, quote, let them down. I'm telling you, that's your one-year-old speaking, that you took responsibility for the suffering of your parents.
Wow.
And how you mustn't let anybody down because it's your responsibility. We take this stuff on so early without words, actually. They just become ingrained, and then we live our lives out of it until something happens, as it did for you. Your body rebelled.
You have a breakdown or something happens, right? Yeah. And you're like, you either keep breaking down or it wakes you up and say, okay, why is this happening?
Exactly.
What is off? What is out of alignment? What is, you know, where am I out of integrity? Whatever it might be.
Exactly.
And I feel the challenge is, I was like, I want to end this suffering. You know, I've repeated this pattern many times. I'm sick and tired of the suffering.
Yeah.
I'll do whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think for me, I was like, I've felt enough of this. I don't want it anymore. But it took so much courage to face these things for me. And I know other people have deeper traumas or different traumas. And it just seems so challenging for people.
I wouldn't go there. I would not compare your trauma to anybody else's.
Well, we all have our unique traumas, right? Different experiences that we face.
That's right.
Why is it so challenging for people to face it and start addressing it? I was telling you, you know, I've been doing pretty intensive therapy for about a year and a half now, every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Not because I feel like something's wrong with me anymore, I'm stressed more, because I want to maintain a level of peace.
Yeah.
And I want to continue to maintain peace.
Good for you.
So once I realized and started healing, I didn't say, I'm good.
Yeah.
I was like, I want to go to the next level of peace, love, you know, an environment of beauty inside of my emotions.
Yeah.
But why is it so hard for so many people to face it and actually speak the shame, guilt, insecurity, you know, imperfection about them?
Well, I think in your own work, you've touched upon very accurately on why it's so difficult. For one thing, if you just the words that you just used, peace and love and connection, if you had played that to your 20-year-old self, how would he have responded?
He'd been like, suck it up, or he'd been like, what are you talking about? You're fine. Like, don't be a little wuss, or, you know, just work harder, you know.
Yeah. But where would that have come from?
I mean, just my entire conditioning growing up from sports and, you know.
Okay, so there's that. So
the house, you know.
So that's one of the factors, is the conditioning in this culture, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I also say it would have come from intense fear. Because if you'd actually, it's very fearful to look at all that pain inside oneself.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying. So there's the intense fear. So there's the conditioning, as you say, then there's the fear. It really is fear, painful. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants to have pain, you know. But that's called growing pains. And the third factor is we all develop this personality. Now, the personality, we think that's us, but it's not us.
Right.
The personality is the traits that we took on to survive our childhoods,
mm-hmm.
along with some genuine traits. So the personality is kind of an amalgam of childhood coping mechanisms and genuine qualities.
Yeah, some good stuff, but then some also coping. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
I remember I used to be like, I was a fun-loving guy. I was like a kind, generous. But then when there was a trigger, was like I was angry and, you know, defensive and guarded and things like that.
Or you talk about the various masks, the sexual mask or the... or the
material mask,
the aggressive mask. Yeah. You know, I when I started reading a chapter on the sexual mask, you wrote about some guy whose name I forget, but who's sort of the champion, picking up women. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be in his shoes for one split second.
Right.
But what's that? It's having to prove to himself that he's lovable.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from? You know, so. But we identify with it.
Yes.
So we think we're the personality. I'm this sexually attractive guy, or I'm this aggressive guy, or I'm this material guy who's going to make it in the world, you know? And so we think that we are our personality. So it comes from, I say, three sources. One is the conditioning. The other is the fear for the pain. And thirdly, the identification with the personality. We think that's who we are, and we don't know who would be without it. All of which is all based on trauma.
Yeah, it's the identity, you know, building this identity that, you know, and I talk about how the identity supported you to accomplishing certain things,
right?
Or protecting you from certain things,
right,
by having this identity.
Yeah.
But it's also not serving us to hold on to that identity if we want the next level of peace and freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's so hard to kill an identity. It's like, well, you've had this thing for decades, maybe. And you've got to let go of this thing. It's
I wouldn't even talk about killing. I mean, I in my healing chapters of this book, I talk about, let's make friends with it.
Mm.
Like, for example, I have to, by the way, I have to be honest. I said that I wouldn't be in this guy's shoes for a minute. That's not true. Part of me was envying him.
Mm, right.
You know, even here, I'm 78 and married 53 years, but I read about this guy who slept with all these women. Why couldn't I be that guy? You know, no, I don't want to go there, and I wouldn't. I've long ago chosen not to, but there's still something that,
mm-hmm,
who doesn't want to be wanted that much,
right?
You know,
something with the ego or the desire,
yeah. So, but if we didn't kill those parts, but made friends with them, if somebody came to me with that kind of pattern of, mm-hmm, I'm that sexual guy, but they don't want to, but they realize that it's not. They might feel high for a moment, like any addict will.
It's not fulfilling.
It's not fulfilling. I wouldn't say kill that part of you. I'd say, let's make friends with it. Let's find out what it's really trying to do for you. What it's trying to do for you is trying to make you feel wanted, making you feel valuable, making you feel desirable, making you feel loved temporarily,
mm-hmm,
making you feel powerful. What happened to you that you don't feel lovable, that you don't feel desirable, that you don't feel powerful? You know, in other words, it's not a matter of getting rid of these parts or these aspects of ourselves. It's a question of actually getting to know them. And they all began as coping mechanisms.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This is actually part one of our interview, and part two will be coming out a few weeks from now. So make sure to follow the show to stay updated.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and it inspired you on your journey towards greatness. Make sure to check out the show notes in the description for a full rundown of today's show with all the important links. And also make sure to share this with a friend and subscribe over on Apple Podcasts as well. I really love hearing feedback from you guys, so share a review over on Apple and let me know what part of this episode resonated with you the most. And if no one's told you lately, I want to remind you that you are loved, you are worthy, and you matter. And now it's time to go out there and do something great.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug, but I ended up connecting to the world around me, a world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Whether you're searching for a home to buy or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. You can favorite homes, share listings with others, and even schedule tours with a local Redfin agent, all in the app. And when you're ready to buy, an experienced local Redfin agent can guide you through the whole process. They know how to help you win the right home at the right price. So download the Redfin app to get started today.